Up next on Coast to Coast, William Warwick IV joins us as we talk about Hopi prophecy and what does it mean to all of us. Stand by. That's next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our special guest William Warwick IV back with us. He was last with us 7.5 years ago, and for more than 10 years, Bill has been researching and investigating his own personal UFO experiences. He has investigated and documented numerous UFO sightings from people all over Virginia and Arizona as well. Tonight, we're going to talk about UFOs and Hopi prophecy as well. William, welcome back, my friend. How have you been? 7.5 years. What have you been doing?
Oh, sounds like a long time, and it certainly has when you put it like that. Well, I've been very busy finishing up some of the books that we started to write over a decade ago, getting ready to publish those very soon. We did an Alien Con, a couple presentations at Alien Con in 2018 in Baltimore, which was really great. And so now we're just finishing up right now with some Hopi work that we've been doing and working on for about 5 or 6 years with one of the elders, one of the last surviving elders of the Hopi clans. And so that's one of the things we're really excited to talk to you about tonight share some of these prophecies that have been locked up in a museum essentially for the past 90 years or so. Grandfather Malava has been kind enough to share some of these stories with me and to hopefully share some of these stories with the world at this time.
Great. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's he asked me, actually, his health is not well, and we've been communicating for about 5 or 6 years now. Actually, this interesting story. My sons and I were planning a trip to Arizona to go and meet Grandfather Malava and do some photo documentation, some video films, that kind of thing, and COVID shut that down, obviously, so
yeah, exactly.
It kind of forced him to reach out and do some more sort of remote sort of documentation work, and so that's where the video came from. There'll be more videos coming soon of Grandfather Malava talking about, he calls them teachings, we might call them prophecies, about things that were written over 90 years ago or more. And that are being revealed right now in the sense that he's translating them and sharing them with the world.
Super. I miss these live events because of COVID, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because one of the only ways that I could communicate with him is through Facebook Messenger, of all things.
Yeah.
And, you know, the good thing about that is he's able to put up, you know, hold up artifacts and things like that to show me some of the things that he's talking about, because most of the things that we've discussed over the past 5 or 6 years, you're not going to find in any book because he has yet to write them. Each Mesa has their own elders and their own traditions, and they're not all the same. So a lot of the stories that we've heard about the quote-unquote Hopi teachings or the prophecies are only of that particular clan's knowledge base, so to speak.
How old is the grandfather, Bill?
He's Grandfather Malava. He's probably, he's got to be in his late 70s, maybe?
70s, yeah.
He was in the Vietnam War, so he's got to be, had to be at least 20 when he went in, you know what I mean?
That's right, exactly. Well, tell us about the Hopi themselves. I mean, tell us about the Hopi tribe based in Arizona, but just tell us about them.
Yeah, so there's actually been a lot of, especially with the new DNA research that's been done, you know, you've got the haplogroup X findings, which would show that there are certain Native American tribes which have this genetic marker, haplogroup X. We know that from genetic studies, and there's more and more things coming out every day that tell us more and more, but essentially, you know, you can think of the Hopi as kind of an offshoot of the Maya at one time, actually. Where there was a lot of things going on in Central America. And so this is kind of like the Maya, like a Hopi group, the Hopi are like a Maya group that kind of branched off at a very, very far date. We don't know, maybe thousands of years ago. And became the Hopi, tradition, so to speak, because Mesta, who's their sort of god/leader, cosmological, I guess, you know, starter of civilization for them, led them to these mesas in Arizona, which just happened to look like or be in the positions of certain constellations, so that these mesas and these sacred sites just happen to mirror the constellations in the sky, just like they do at various sites around the world.
Well, they've been around a long time. And how did Hopi prophecy occur, Bill?
Well, it's mostly just, you know, the priests of the individual clans telling their stories. Sometimes it's information that's passed to them from spirits or Pachina dolls, so to speak. But, I mean, a lot of it just sounds like the same kind of Chilam Balam type priest, I guess you would call clairvoyance, where they're able to just see the future. You know, and I've experienced this in Guatemala as well with the Chilam Balam prophecies that were so accurate in describing the things that are happening right now. But I think at the core of it all, because I've studied the Maya and the Hopi now for a number of years, over a decade, they see things in cycles. We see things in the Western mind as a linear progression of things, you know, from 0 to 1,000, right, or 0 to 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Native American mind, they see everything as a cycle. So, you know, the cycle of the seasoning, the planting of corn and the reaping of corn and farming cycles and the cycles of the seasons, the cycles of the animals when they, you know, when they mate, when they breed, and when they have children. So from a Native American mindset, or any indigenous people's mindset, really, they see things in cycles. They don't see things as linear, meaning that they're able to predict things that are going to happen in the future based on things that happened in the past. And so the interesting thing about the Hopi and the Maya traditions is that what we consider to be, excuse me, what we consider to be maybe prophecies is really to them just a continual observation of things that's been going on for thousands of years. And so they can look back at what happened 3,000, you know, 200 years ago and look to this time period right now and say, well, every 5,200 years, this happens, right? Or expect this. And so to the outside world, it looks like prophecy, but really it's just observation.
True. The Hopis had about 9 signs, with the final sign being devastated. We'll get into that a little bit later in the program. Tell me about your approach with the Hopis. How did you come across the Grandfather Malava?
It's a good question. So I think Gary David is an excellent author. I'm sure, I think you've had him on your show.
Yeah, he's been on. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an excellent Hopi historian and author. He's written several books about it. He's got a great new book that just came out. I have not had a chance to read it yet. But I believe that's how I got introduced initially, and then about 6 years ago. And since that time, you know, Grandfather Malava and I have talked. I call him Grandfather Malava. His name is Martin Hawato. He's they're so kind and they're so knowledgeable and mm-hmm. so ready and willing to give up their time to the people that, you know, are willing to give them the equal respect and time, so to speak. And so it's really just been a labor of love to just listen to the stories and the information he has to share, because a lot of this, George, it could be 50,000-year-old information.
That's true. That's true.
I tell people that, and they go, oh, that's a crazy. They can only have a 3,000-year-old civilization. And I say, no, you're wrong. You're absolutely positively wrong. They're describing events that we know happened, you know, maybe 50,000 years ago with asteroid strikes and stuff like that, when they talk about the three phases of the phases of civilization that have been destroyed, and we're in the fourth or fifth one, depending on which calendar or which, you know, knowledge stream you go by. And so we're coming to the end of that sort of period now, and there's actually very scientific, this is what's mind-boggling, a completely scientific way of explaining their cosmology and what they were taught about these things that seem so unbelievably difficult to understand, and now are so simple to us. And I'll explain that when we get into the helpers and their story of creation. So their story of creation basically talks about Spider Woman who came and was traveling through space and decided that they were going to basically, they saw the Earth was wobbling in space, right? And decided they were going to come down and fix it. So the two helpers, who were the nephews of Spider-Woman, come down, and they're sent to the poles of the Earth, right?
Hmm.
And they're sent to the poles of the Earth to basically balance the Earth, because at that particular time, apparently, the wobble of the Earth was not steady. It was not 23.5 degrees as it is now. It was going all over the place, meaning it was an unsteady wobble. So the two helpers are sent to the poles, and of course, when you read the initial story, you, from the Western standpoint of view, you think, okay, what are they talking about? But really, you have to think of it from an indigenous standpoint of view, where they use metaphors for everything, right? Because how could you explain to someone 5,000 years ago that there was an ice cap at the poles of each Earth, and those two ice caps actually stabilized the Earth like a spinning top, right? Couldn't understand that. So they just said the nephews and they used all these metaphors. But now that we have the scientific understanding to translate that in another way, we can say, oh, okay, what they're talking about is they're talking about the ice caps at the ends of the Earth, which stabilized the wobble of the Earth during the last ice age. And that's actually what happened. So now this purification that they're talking about is not actually about this event that's going to happen because God wants to punish us, as much as it is kind of a human-made event, because we've allowed carbon dioxide and all these gases into the atmosphere that's increased the amount of solar energy that's absorbed, different energy that's absorbed, and now that has melted the two ice caps. So because we're melting the ice caps, this causes the Earth to become more unstable, and eventually what will happen is we'll have another crustal ice displacement And a crustal shift, which is what Charles Hapgood was writing about. And then that's where the purification is going to come, because we weren't smart enough and peaceful enough to stop global warming.
Interesting.
We're spending all of our time killing each other in weapons of mass destruction instead of concentrating on protecting the environment, essentially.
How did the Hopi pass their stories along? Did they put them in a book, or was it word of mouth?
Totally verbal, as far as I understand it, with the exception of what Grandfather Malava would call the wall paintings, or what we would call petroglyphs, right? So part of the initiation ceremonies for the Hopi was that each clan member would have to go down to certain places, certain sacred sites, like in the Grand Canyon, and they would have to go down there, and as they would make their journey down to the sacred site to do whatever they were supposed to do at the sacred site, they would actually leave their clan marks along the way. So a lot of these petroglyphs that we see are actually the clan markings that go back thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, of these peoples, this tribe, going back and leaving their marks on the petroglyphs. And So there's this verbal tradition, which was passed down basically from father to son, from priest to priest, as we would say. And then you had the petroglyphs, of course, to back that up, to help tell the story. So they had a little bit of both, but it was mostly verbal, as far as I understand.
And apparently the translations stayed pretty accurate as they passed them down. Unlike, you know, what we would do in school, where you have 40 kids and, you know, you tell a story all the way through and it's totally different by the time it gets to the last kid.
Yeah. Well, I think the use of metaphors was very, that's kind of, I think, why they use certain metaphors to describe certain things. So, for instance, Grandfather Malava was, this new prophecy that comes up, which we have on our website, it's actually Facebook, but the WikiLeaks UFOs, he describes, for instance, he pauses for a moment when he's reading the translation, and he says, you know, this phrase is describing women that have babies without fathers, and then he says that means like artificial insemination. So he was describing things that would happen in the future that were written in the 1930s about stuff that's happening now. Of course, you know, when was artificial insemination? 1970? I can't remember.
Probably right around then, yeah.
Yeah, so how could they have even imagined that, let alone tried to come up with the phrase to describe that, like women who are having babies without fathers, you know what I mean? Like, it's just amazing how they use language, even back then, to describe things that they could never have known about or even imagined hadn't even been invented yet, and yet they described it with such accuracy that when you listen to Grandfather Malava, you know, describe what was written over 90 years ago, it's like a page from the headlines of today. He's talking about wildfires that are out of control that no one could control. Like, I was like, wow, that's now.
Well, who are the ant people, Bill, that the Hopis talk about? Because I think they're either extraterrestrials that look like ants and they witness them, or humans who lived underground. What do you think?
You know, it's a great question. We've had several conversations over the years to try to get a better understanding of just who the whole cosmology here. Who are the ant people? Who are the stone people? Who are the mud people? Who are the blue men? Like, if you want to understand anything about ufology, and you know this is where I kind of started from the very beginning.
That's right.
You cannot understand anything that's going on with UFOs today. If you do not have a good fundamental understanding of the Native American indigenous interactions with them, because they are the ones who have all of the keys to the kingdom.
They were witnesses.
So exactly. And they know what's going on. Like, they've known for centuries. And I have a feeling that's why a lot of these reservations were created, actually. So let me tell you a little bit about the Yan people so we answer your question, because it's a very important question, and I think we need to expound on it a little bit. So what Grandfather Malava actually said, and let me be careful because I have to be, is that, let's just put it this way. Some of the things that we think are extraterrestrial may not actually be extraterrestrial, meaning that there are beings which we share the Earth with, okay,
mm-hmm.
that evolved on the Earth along with us that lived underground.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
And I think that's possible.
I think it's entirely possible. It's there's so much surface area, there's so much cubic feet of area under the ground. You could have multiple civilizations if they're underground that could be hidden from us that we wouldn't know anything about. We wouldn't know nothing about them. And what's interesting about the ant people is what my grandfather Malava said is that apparently at one point in time humans. We all know the story of the Anunnaki and the Sumerians, how they came here to create us, mm-hmm. and all that. That's all over. Everybody knows that story. But I don't think anybody knew the story of the ant people were also enslaved, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
So I thought that was fascinating. I was like, whoa, wait a minute, wait. So in addition to the humans being created to be slaves, you're saying that there was a whole other species that we don't know anything about that was also enslaved? And he's like, yes. And I was like, wow, that's like next level. So I said, okay, tell me a little bit more about the ant people. And so essentially, without getting into too much stuff that would be inappropriate to talk about.
I get it.
Because there's certain things I can't talk about, and I won't talk about because it's sacred. And we share this planet with other species, period.
Now, do the species, do they look human, or do they look more like ants?
They're 3 to 4 feet tall. They have antennae. They look like miniature. If you took an ant and turned it into a small human, not a human, but an ant, you know what I mean?
And kind of gave it a body to it or something?
Absolutely. Now, what's fascinating about this is this ties into a story running into the pyramids, okay? So apparently part of the story of the cosmology of the Hopi is that the two helpers went to the two poles of the Earth to balance the wobble of the Earth. Because before that, it was not just wobbling all over the place, and the climate couldn't get under control, and life was having trouble getting started because you need a stable wobble in order to create that. So part of the story is that the ant people, right, were made to rebuild the pyramids, actually rebuild them.
Interesting. Stay with that, Bill. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back and talk about the ant people. Later on, we'll talk about the Blue Star Kachina, and that's a dramatic story all by itself. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we will take your phone calls with Bill Warwick as we talk about Hopi prophecy, but we've got lots more to talk with him about when we come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Bill Warwick with us. Bill, back to the ant people fascinates me. So these entities are about 2 to 3 feet tall, maybe a little taller. They have antennae, and they have the bodies of an ant or more of a human?
From the descriptions that Grandfather Malaver have given me, they look like miniature ant people. That's the best way to describe them. Like,
wow, I'd love to see one of those.
Yeah. They apparently have crystals that they use to actually illuminate, you know, the underground chambers that they live in. From what I understand, they're not carnivorous, so they probably produce some kind of bacteria or fungus that they live off of. Not really sure how that works, but they seem to be extremely peaceful. There are dozens of stories that Grandfather Malaver has shared with me over the years about them. I want to talk on a couple of things that I found extremely fascinating. I know your listeners, you're going to love this as well, George. So,
sure.
The Hopi call the three great pyramids anthills. And Grandfather Malaver showed me a bowl that he had, actually, a ceramic bowl that it was over 2,000 years, and he showed me these little triangles. I said, well, what is that? And he's like, well, those are the anthills. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He's like, well, those are the three great pyramids. I said, so you have a bowl, a pre-Columbian bowl that's 2,000 years old, and he's showing it to me, and that has depictions of the three great pyramids. He said, yes, this is part of our teachings. And I was like, wow, okay, that's next level stuff, right? So he tells me the story of the anthills, which are the three great pyramids. He said the ant people built the pyramids. And I said, really? He said, yes, they did. So I said, well, how is that even possible? I'm thinking this in my mind. So now the ant people built the pyramids. I said, so I investigate a little bit more, and I look into it. I said, wait, this kind of might explain something, because if you ever look at the Great Pyramid itself, the outside casing stones were limestone, and those were polished, right? But the interior, once you get one layer deep, is rough,
mm-hmm.
right? It's extremely rough. In fact, it's very rough. So then I was like, well, wait a second, is there such a thing as stone cutting ants? So Google stone cutting ants. Yes, there are, right? So apparently there's stone cutting ants that release formic acid, and the formic acid helps to eat away at the stone, and they cut the stone away, and they convert it and with the minerals and stuff like that. So I'm like, oh my God, wait a minute. So this is actually scientifically possible. Yes, it is. So then I said, well, wait a second. Maybe this would explain, to Grandfather Malaver, I said, well, that might make sense because ants can lift, you know, 10, 20 times their own weight.
That's
so if you
true.
Had a three-foot
That's
ant
true.
Colony of people, ant people, that might explain how they were able to build those pyramids and get those blocks set in place, because two or three ants could probably lift a whole block by themselves.
Interesting. Or they knew sound resonance or something.
I mean, just think of the... I've been in the jungle in Belize and watched an ant, you know, colony transfer a leaf that was 10, 15, 20 times its own size and at like 1 mile per hour.
Well, this is what's amazing, too, is how did the Hopi, based in Arizona, know about pyramids in Egypt?
Exactly. Pre-Columbian artifacts, right? With Egyptian stuff on it. And we could get into more stuff with that. That'll be a whole entirely different show. I have a mask from Africa. That is from a tribe in Africa, west coast of Africa. It's like a death mask, but not necessarily a death mask. That's the wrong thing to call it. That Grandfather Malaver found in the Grand Canyon. His grandfather found it in the Grand Canyon, buried under 10 feet of sand on a riverbank. And this is a pre-Columbian mask. I have it in my possession. We believe pre-Columbian. I mean, we haven't done any testing on it, but just the age of it and where he said it was found, the depth that it was found, it has to be pre-Columbian. It looks almost, it's not Dogon. It's a separate tribe on the west coast of Africa that had certain markings that they did. We've been able to trace it back to that. But, like, there's definitely so much more to the Hopi story that we have not been told.
Well, you just scratched the surface. What is the 40-mile road story, Bill?
Oh, hold on. We'll circle back to that. I want to tell you a couple more things. So, in addition to the pyramids, I'm looking at the pyramids trying to understand how this might have been created by the ant people. Well, the concrete, there's a concrete that scientists don't really understand that holds together the interior blocks of the Great Pyramid. And I'm thinking that that could be an excretion from the ants. Like if the ants were able to create formic acid and they were stone cutting ants or something, they might have been able to excrete something that took the formic acid or whatever microbiology thing. Like we do geotextiles right now. I have two patents and I filed for geotextiles, so I find this absolutely fascinating. The scientists don't know how that concrete was created to hold the mortar to create some of those stones together. So that could have been done by the ant people. And then if you look at the interior, which is, this always puzzled me as well, the interior of the Great Pyramid, the way that the interior chambers slope, those weren't really made for humans. But if you look at the side view of the Great Pyramid and compare it to an anthill, right, or an ant colony, it almost looks the same. You have all these chambers coming in and out at different angles. So an ant people could definitely navigate those chambers with no problem.
Right.
They humans, not so much.
They don't understand it.
And everything.
Maybe that concrete is ant spit, for all we know.
That's what I'm saying. Not only that, but it would also explain why there are no hieroglyphs in the Great Pyramid. Because the ant people aren't going to be like, hey, Joe is here in ant language. Like, no, they use chemical signals from their abdomen to communicate. So, and on the onset, the idea of the ant people building the pyramid seemed entirely incredulous. And then after doing some scientific research, I was like, wait a minute, no, this would explain everything. This would explain all of the anomalies that we see. The casing stones that were put on were done by humans later on, much later on.
Interesting take.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And now the 40 Road story. What is that?
Ooh, the 40 Mile Road story. So Grandfather Malala told us a story the other day.
All right.
About how his he had a sister-in-law that just passed away, literally a week ago, and he was recounting the story he hadn't thought about for a long time, and the story is basically about how his sister-in-law in the 1960s, early 1959, 1960s, recounting the story. How his sister-in-law had a baby, a young infant, maybe 3 years old, and they lived in this down this road. They call it the 40-mile road. It's from Winslow to the Hopi Reservation. And along this road was where his sister-in-law lived, and she had a young infant. And during this blizzard, 1960 time period, she went out to get some groceries or something like that, and came as on her way back to her house where the infant was. She saw these lights and around the house, filled up the whole house with light, though, these different color lights and stuff like that. And her grandmother had come to be with her, and they were distracted by the lights, I guess you could say, for a little bit. And then the grandmother was like, well, where's the baby? And so they went and looked for the baby, couldn't find the baby. So, they kind of panicked a little bit, did a little quick search around to make sure that, the baby had gotten out of the crib and walked around. Of course, there's this blizzard going on, so the snow's all over the place. So if there was, if the baby had gotten out and walked away, they would have seen tracks or something. And
right.
The Native Americans, they know how to track. There's nothing out there. They're in the middle of this, plain, with just one tree literally next to their house. So it's not like they wouldn't be able to see an infant, long story short, three days goes by and they call out the DIA, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they come out and they search, they can't find anything. So they call the FBI out. The FBI comes out, they can't find anything. It's just like two or three days into it now, the blizzard starts to come back, and they still can't find the child. So now they start looking at the grandmother and the mother, thinking, is there some kind of foul play? So they kind of rule that out. And, of course, the grandmother and the mother telling the story about the lights and Grandfather Mother, obviously, during this time period, there were lights seen all over the place, basically all over the reservation. And he said, this is interesting because back then, he said there was actually no fly zone over the reservation. So it was a restricted area. You couldn't fly over it back in the 60s. And he said even back then, in the 60s, there'd be no reason for anyone to fly over. So there's nothing there. So 40 Mile Road. So this is the road that, you know, basically you go down to get through this area where her sister-in-law lived. And 3 days goes by, and the blizzard starts to come back. And it's just very, very small road to get where you need to go. And one couple comes by, and they're driving down the road. You can't see very far. And you see something crawling in the road, and they can't figure out what it was, so they go by. And then a few minutes later, another trucker goes by, and he sees this thing in the road and pulls over and to go see what it is, and it's the child.
Oh, wow.
The child that's been missing for 3 days.
Jeez.
And
alive.
And alive. And
that's
not
the amazing
frostbitten or hungry or, you know, anything, just covered with snow, like it had just been dropped off there a few minutes earlier, alive, intact, so to speak. I mean, and this is the story. This is the 40 Mile Road story. He tells it much more eloquently. It's a 20-minute story.
No, you did a good job with that, to paraphrasing it,
yeah.
Of course. I'm going to ask you a couple questions, and I think after the break, before we take calls, we'll talk about the Blue Star, because that's a pretty dramatic story.
Sure.
But who is the Pahana?
Well, B as in Bahana or P as in Pahana?
Pahana.
Because,
P.
Yeah, with the P. So I asked him about that. We've had a couple of conversations about that. So there is this story within the Hopi that there is this the coming white brother, okay? The prophecy coming back, or the return of the true white brother is a better description of it. And so I guess there have been how much can I talk about? So I guess various people have tried to come back and claim that they were the true white brother and didn't work out too well for them. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
And so I think they're still waiting. They don't know who the true white brother is to answer.
Is this like a return of Jesus or something, or totally different?
You know, that's a good question, because there are definitely somewhat Christian elements in some of the teachings. Like, for instance, one of their teachings is about Messiah. Before he leaves, he basically says, you know, I am the first and I am the last, which is interesting because that mirrors, you know, what Jesus said, you know, I am the Alpha and I am the Omega, which is basically saying I am the first and I am the last. So the question is, was there some kind of Christian influence over the Hopi at some period in time, which happens a lot sometimes in like mine and some of these other indigenous communities? You get overlap of the Christian ideas because they were Christianized. And so I don't think that's the case. I think Jesus might have been an inherent to the Mayans, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of evidence. People think I'm going crazy. There'd be a whole other show involved with that. But essentially, I think that...
He was Quetzalcoatl or something, right?
Yes. There are a lot of different traditions, and we have a lot of different misunderstandings about what, for instance, Quetzalcoatl is. It has more to do with an inner... development of our own inner faculties, and we become Quetzalcoatl because, for instance, we become Quetzalcoatl when we become enlightened, right? These are very kind of more complex spiritual things that the minds will teach you. But getting back to Pahana, though, I think that it's the return of the true white brother, in the sense that it could be the return. You could think of it as a metaphor for the return of Western us, man, white, like white people in general, right? Because part of their mythology, part of the cosmology is that there were four root races: the red man, the black man, the white man, and the yellow man. And so we each of the four races was given its own task of guardianship for the earth, and the white man was given fire, right? So and what do we control now? Like weapons of mass destruction, jet engines, our whole entire civilization is fire. We create electricity by burning coal or nuclear energy to create steam to turn a generator, which creates electricity. It's fire. It's all fire, which is interesting because that's what we're in control of. So I think the return of the true right brother, in a metaphorical sense, might be the return of the truest sense of the white race, using fire in the proper way, meaning instead of using it to destroy, we use it to create. And that's what it was initially meant for. And that's where we as the white race, the Western civilization, has gone wrong. So I think when they talk about Pahana, the return of the true white brother, they're waiting for the return of the true indigenous environmental aspect of what we're seeing expressed today, which is the expression of compassion and wanting to be united that not only our country, but all countries and all nations want to have on a worldwide level. Like, that's what we're missing as being the true white brother, in my opinion.
Bill, do you think other Native American societies have this kind of mythology as the Hopi, or are the Hopi very unique with this kind of mythology?
I think they're unique in the sense that they have one of the truest and oldest original indigenous untouched. Because you got to understand, they never signed any treaties with anybody. They're still in the same land that Masao gave them and told them to protect and to be the guardians of. We don't know, 40,000 years, 50,000 years ago. They have it. That's how Orabi, the community in Orabi, is the oldest continuously inhabited civilization, city, whatever you want to call it, in the United States that we know of.
So, how many numbers are there? How many Hopi are still alive?
Ooh, not a lot. I mean, I'm going to go on a limb and say maybe 100,000, maybe 150,000.
That's it?
I don't know. I could be totally wrong. I wouldn't say it was more than that. No. And this COVID thing for the Navajo community and a lot of the indigenous communities has really been devastating. That's I think part of the reason why Grandfather Malava wants to get this out as quickly as possible, because look, there's no guarantees anymore. You know what I mean?
They're dying off.
Yeah.
All right, well, stay with us, Bill. We're going to come back in just a moment and take some phone calls with you. But first, I'm going to want to ask you about the Blue Star Katina and what that all means. It's the final sign of destruction described by the Hopis. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.